I personally don't believe the fire is going to get into the basin proper, but that could, I could be born wrong by that. The weather has outstripped, and Mother Nature has taken over and taken fires like the Dixie to places that I never thought was possible.
CAL FIRE Chief Tom Porter on Monday addressing the Caldor Fire in El Dorado County, about halfway between Sacramento and Lake Tahoe. So far, he has been proven right. The fire is still miles away from the towns that surround Lake Tahoe. But the Caldor Fire has already burned more than 125,000 acres. And CAL FIRE is calling it the number one priority in the nation for firefighters. Mike Perrin joins me now. He's been overseeing Caldor Fire coverage for the Tahoe Daily Tribune and the Sierra Sun. Welcome.
Thank you for having me, Madeline.
Well, why is it the number one priority in the nation?
Well, you know, we've got a national treasure here, Lake Tahoe, right? I mean, hopefully you guys have come up to check it out, whether it's winter or summer, and seen
yeah,
the bluebird skies, the crystal clear waters. So rightfully so, a lot of people are going to care about this place, and it's approaching quick. But that soundbite you played at the intro there was just, it's music to my ears. But it's really, really tough to get people to believe that, because we are living day in, day out of AQI, air quality index of 800 plus the last 3 to 5 days, depending on where you're at in the Tahoe Basin. So that insight is not shared by everyone.
So 800 plus, what's normal?
So normal would be 100. All right. And wow. AQI is only supposed to go to about 300. So it is literally off the charts. We've had the worst air quality in the nation, when generally we have the most pure mountain air here. And it is putting a lot of people in panic, even though we get these messages from CAL FIRE, from El Dorado County representatives, from our local city officials that are all working in tandem. And, you know, it's tough to keep people, you know, calm right now.
So are people worried that the CAL FIRE chief say that he doesn't expect it to move toward Lake Tahoe and to the communities there? There are what, about 22,000 people in South Lake Tahoe? Are those people worried, though, that the fire will reach them? Are you worried?
Very worried. Yeah, it's quite a bit of panic going on right now. Personally, myself, I get this question a lot. And, you know, my percentage, as in to if I think my home personally is going to burn down as in South Lake Tahoe, I'll give it a 2% chance. 2% is too much, if you ask a lot of people or myself, right? But it gets you in that sense of preparedness. But then there's always that chance of these spot fires, because I say 2% chance of this wildfire crossing the Echo Ridge, which is the main pass between the Bay Area and Sacramento, coming and dropping into Lake Tahoe. So it's got to get over that steep ridge and then drop down in. But here's the kicker. You've got these burning embers. We've been dealing with ash falling in our city for the last 5 days now. And these spot fires that can blow over the ridge and drop down into our neighborhoods are the real scary part. But local officials say they're ready for that. They have not, you know, dispatched everybody out to the fire. They are keeping some people local for instances like that if they were to happen. So that's comforting in a sense, knowing that we've still got our boots on the ground here in the city of South Lake Tahoe.
Do you have your go bag packed?
We sure do. You know, my wife does. We've got a 6-month-old baby dealing with the smoke that's seeping into the house, and a dog. So they are ready to pounce when that word is given. I, on the other hand, will, you know, limp along and try to prepare the house. But, you know, we haven't even hit an evacuation warning yet. There's a big, you know, a misconception between evacuation warning and evacuation mandate. So, you know, there's the yellow on the map, the red on the map, and it gets a lot of people stirred up. And we haven't even hit the warning yet. And, you know, it's not like a wildfire that has caught us off guard. We know this is creeping towards us now. Like I said, there can be a spot fire that catches us off guard, but this is creeping towards us, and we're going to get a lot of advanced warning about this. But the big thing here is that, you know, we only have 6 inlets and outlets in and out of Lake Tahoe for the entire Tahoe Basin, one of which is now shut down, that Highway 50 corridor where the fire is burning. So we've got 5 outlets now for all of these people to evacuate if that does happen, that's where you start to get a little worried as well, is okay, what, how's it going to play out if it does happen?
So I understand there was a community meeting last night. What was discussed there?
Well, there's that's an interesting one, right? Because there wasn't a lot of information released. The El Dorado County Sheriff representative did say we have a point in which we know that if the fire reaches this exact longitude, latitude coordinates, we will give you an evacuation notice. But we're not going to tell you where that is. That caused a lot of stir with the locals here. You know, the sort of that withholding information vibe putting off that was probably the sticking point. Not a lot of substantial information that we didn't already know. I think it was more a show of PR, if you ask me.
A lot of people relocated there during the pandemic from the Bay Area, and I'm wondering if they might not have as much experience dealing with forest fires and understanding how to handle them and handle a possible evacuation.
Oh, that's a great point. I mean, we dealt with that in the winter too, right? After they all did move here, and that was a big issue, is people not knowing how to drive in the snow full time or clear their driveways. And so now here we go again, now with the new normal for summer. You know, the entire summer is now fire season in basically all of California. And yeah, you're completely right. There's a lot of people taken off guard here and saying, how do I deal with this? And there's so many resources out there and really spelled out in, especially in ways of, you know, you've got 4 hours to evacuate. Here's what you got to bring. 2 hours. Here's what you have to bring. And they really break it down very simply for the people that aren't used to dealing with this. So, but yeah, that's a great point. A lot of people shocked by they thought they were moving to the pure, pristine Lake Tahoe. And here we are in 800 AQI.
All right, Mike. Well, stay safe, and I hope the air clears up for you there.
I appreciate it. Yeah, you can probably hear the hoarseness in my voice. It's taken a toll on everyone here. So thank you for your well wishes.
Of course. Mike Perrin, he's been overseeing fire coverage for the Tahoe Daily Tribune and the Sierra Sun. California's drought is so bad right now, the state is forcing thousands of Central Valley farmers and landowners to make major cuts to their water use. It's really a crisis for the area and for California. The cuts only apply to surface water, you know, the water that sits in reservoirs. There's a way that farmers can try to make up for those water losses, though. They can use well water extracted from aquifers deep underground. Except, a lot of those wells are running dry. Journalist and author Mark Arak spent some time following a man whose job it is to fix the wells bringing water to those farms. He told Arak that the drought conditions he's working in now, well, it's challenged everything he believes in. Arak wrote about this for The Atlantic, and he joins me now. Hi.
Hey, how you doing?
I'm doing well. Well, your story centered on a man named Matt Angel, and he has spent many decades fixing wells in the Central Valley. Tell us more about him. Who is he?
Matt Angel has a pump company called Madera Pumps in the county of Madera. He happens to be a farmer growing, a couple hundred acres of grapes and almonds. He's a soil scientist, a drip irrigation expert. So he's kind of comes right out of central casting in terms of someone who's an expert on water and the means by which we're extracting this water from the earth.
And this part of the state, Madera County, this is just to give listeners an idea. This is north of Fresno and up to, well, around Yosemite, right? That part of the state.
It's in the dead center of the state. In fact, there's a palm tree right along Highway 99 that's supposed to be the middle of the state, and it's right there. So, and it's along just north of the San Joaquin River.
And forever, for as long as California has been farmed, this has been a very fertile region.
Oh, yeah, extremely fertile region. That you're talking about the alluvial soil that came from the river, and so it's primo soil, at least the original, you know, farming was. What's happened, and this is the heart of this story, is that farming, just like suburbia, continues to sprawl outward and outward, so that now they're farming ground that is third and fourth rate. And there's no rivers serving this ground, so they have to go deep into the earth to find the water.
And who's the they? These are not the original farmers, or at least the descendants of the original farmers. These are relatively new farmers, some of whom are basically corporations.
Yeah, that's the struggle that's going on. So you have these family farmers who, you know, their story is three, four generations deep in the soil. And they carved out the best ground first. And they've been joined now by insurance companies, John Hancock, hedge funds, pension funds, the Mormon Church. I mean, who knew that the Mormon Church is one of the biggest growers of fruits and vegetables, you know, in California? Actually, mostly nuts now. So you have this competition for the water. And the original farmers draw, you know, water from the San Joaquin River, but that's in years when there's snow melt. The last 10 years, there's virtually been no real snow melt come down that river, except for maybe a year or two. And so they take some of the river water, that surface water, but they also rely on the groundwater, those longtime family farmers. And they're competing now with these big, big corporations from afar that are able to put their pumps deep into the ground. And they're sucking, they're creating it's called a cone of depression. And they're sucking the water literally out from underneath the family farmers, out to them. And you're not only seeing the aquifer drop in a way that the well fixer, Matt Angel, says is, he used to say that this was unprecedented. Now he says, I have to use the word biblical to describe the kind of extraction that's taking place. And, wow. And so not only is the aquifer sinking, it's descended 60 feet in a matter of 3 months. I mean, that is just, it's astonishing, that kind of drop. And then along with it comes a subsidence where the earth itself is dropping. And that earth, so all the infrastructure, all the pumps, the canals, the ditches, the aqueduct that moves water from the north where all our rain is, all the way south through this valley and all, up and into Los Angeles, your faucets and swimming pools, that infrastructure is also sinking. So we're losing the gravity flow that this incredible system of moving water relies on to get it from north to south.
Wow, that is fascinating. So that the actual earth is being affected by this pumping of the aquifer. Is the aquifer there going dry?
Yeah, the aquifer. So the pumps are having to go ever deeper to find water. And this is ancient water. This is water that's been stored under there for, you know, since millennia. So as that water gets sucked out, the clay layers in the soil end up drawing down. And as they draw down, they bring the earth with it. And so the sinking starts in inches. It's almost invisible. It's like termites eating at your house. You don't really see it. And then at some point, the inches become feet. And that's what we're seeing now.
That term, cone of depression, it's so evocative. So when Matt Angel went out to fix these wells, was he able to do that? Was he able to bring up any water at all for these farmers?
Well, he took me out to an almond orchard. And, you know, this is one almond orchard in the 2,350 square mile vastness of almond orchards up and down the state of California. And there was a well in the ground that he had just fixed in the last drought. It was brand new. 6-7 years ago. And it was only producing a trickle of water. So as he went down with his camera into that hole in the ground, trying to recall where the water was, that great lake beneath the ground. He couldn't find it. It wasn't where he remembered it. And he had to keep going down and down. And all he could locate, the flow was so pinched off, he could only locate a trickle. And that trickle was so laden with salt that it was killing the orchard. The orchard was burning up from the salt. So this is a well that should have lasted 20, 30, 40 years, you know. Instead, it was barely broken in, and yet it had gone dry. And as he started going out to these other wells and servicing them, I mean, these are farm wells, business wells, house wells, the junior high school well, the high school well, they were all sucking up air.
So he's in this really strange position, unprecedented for him. On the one hand, as a well fixer, he can charge these farmers a lot of money to fix the wells or at least bring up maybe some water. But he's coming out and talking about it and pretty vocal about the fact that he can't keep doing this. So is he putting himself out of business? Why is he speaking out?
Well, he's speaking out in the name of his community. I mean, they're on the brink of losing a way of life that goes back a century and a half. That's how drastic what's happening is happening right now. So I think he's caught between. At one point, he told me that, you know, I could make a lot of money fixing these between now and the time, you know, hell arrives. But, you know, I wouldn't be able to look my son in the eye. His son is in the farm business with him. So I think it's, you know, for moral reasons, for existential reasons, you know, that he has to tell this story. And yeah, it's not just the financial risk. You know, you have farmers right now there that are trying to sell their land to these hedge funds and pension funds who really don't care about the water. You know, they could care less that it's going down, 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 because for them, they're looking at a short-term profit. In fact, they don't even mind if it's a loss because it's something they could write off on their books. So as he's telling this story, you know, his neighbors are saying, hey, keep quiet. You know, I'm trying to negotiate a deal here with one of these pension funds from back east. So he's decided, you know, to come forward. And I think it takes a tremendous amount of courage to do so. And, you know, I was going to call him the well fixer throughout, almost like a parable, almost, you know, and he said, no, you can use my name. And so that's how the story went.
Where does he see the story going? What happens? This drought is likely going to continue. It's only going to get hotter because of climate change. If things don't change, what does the valley look like?
Well, yeah, that's a question that I asked myself in the last book I did, The Drempland, and I end up in Madera County, basically saying that this is in 2017 with some of the very farmers that are, you know, had encouraged Matt to talk. And they, you know, we concluded at that point in 2017, at the end of the last drought, that the center of California was one more drought away from being tapped out, its aquifer being tapped out. And so that's exactly what's taking place now a few years later. And it really calls for a new way of conceiving California. I mean, can we continue to sprawl the footprint of farmland ever wider? Okay. Can we continue to build houses in the path of wildfire? Can we continue to grow houses across the desert of Southern California? Does climate change obligate us to change the way we've been growing California? I think this is the question we're now confronted with. This is the question that he brings into stark relief.
Hmm. So meanwhile, even though we're in this either two droughts or one mega drought, there have been lots of almond and pistachio trees planted, 500,000 acres. So that and these take up a lot of water, these nut trees.
This is really a story of delusion. It's a story of communal madness. where in the driest period in California's recorded history, this is even drier than the 1920s, the decade that brought us the Great Central Valley Project, okay? In that decade, in the San Joaquin Valley alone, that's not the whole Central Valley, that's just half of it, we have added 550,000 acres of new almonds and pistachios. The almond is a great user of water. I mean, alfalfa for the mega dairies is more, but almonds are using a great deal of water here. We've got 1.5 million acres of almonds, probably 1.7 million. And so where's this all end? And we have a new state law that it took us 170 years, but we decided to finally regulate the taking of groundwater. I mean, we think of California as a progressive and now liberal state, but when it comes to the extraction of natural resources, we're very libertarian. So we've passed this law that's supposed to bring sanity to it, but it has a run-up of 20 years. There's not going to be an aquifer left in 20 years if we don't start dealing with this now.
Author and journalist Mark Arecs. You can read his piece in The Atlantic. It's called The Well Fixer's Warning. Mark, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Coming up, who is Kevin Paffrath? The 29-year-old YouTuber is running second in polls to replace Governor Gavin Newsom in the recall election. We'll find out more about him next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Most of the 45 candidates running to replace Governor Gavin Newsom in the recall election are Republicans, but there are nearly a dozen Democrats on the ballot. One in particular, a 29-year-old with more than 1 million YouTube followers. He is getting some traction. His name is Kevin Paffrath. He's polling second, just behind conservative talk show host Larry Elder. He's a real estate broker, he's an investor, and a prolific vlogger under the name Meet Kevin.
Hey everyone, Meet Kevin here. In this video, I'm going to walk you through a step-by-step process on how to buy your first rental property.
Hey everyone, welcome back to another Tesla earnings conference.
Why does California, the fifth largest economy in the world, struggle with crime, schooling, homelessness, and can't even keep the power on or supply our farms with enough water?
And according to his website, Kevin Paffrath bills himself as a true JFK-style Democrat, bringing back California's exceptionalism. Here to tell us what that means is Ben Christopher. He covers California politics and elections for Cal Matters. Hi.
Hello.
Well, you spoke with him for, what, about 90 minutes? What was your sense of him at the end of that interview?
As you can probably tell from the clips that we just heard, he's a very charismatic, very confident person, and he's really made a reputation for himself sort of doling out advice on how to make money in real estate, and also dabbling in sort of general financial advice around cryptocurrency and stock market and that kind of thing. And then I think he kind of surprised a lot of people when he decided to run for governor, and he's surprised even more people by actually doing quite well in some polls, as you mentioned. I think he'd be the first person to admit that he doesn't have a traditional background. He doesn't fit the bill as a traditional politician. He doesn't have any elected experience. And I think that's, I guess, part of his selling point is that he comes as a complete outsider.
Mm-hmm. Well, why is he polling second? Who's supporting him?
in some ways, this is maybe a candidacy of Governor Gavin Newsom's own making. And by that, I mean, Newsom and the California Democratic Party did everything in their power to discourage prominent Democrats from running in the recall. And their intent was to keep this a partisan affair as much as possible. And so a number of Democrats, sort of lesser known Democrats, did run. And one of them was Kevin Paffrath. And he was really the only Democrat with any degree of following. As you mentioned, he has 1.7 million subscribers on YouTube. It became this kind of self-fulfilling media cycle where when pollsters started asking Californians how they feel about this upcoming recall and who they might support, you know, rather than listing all 46 candidates who are running, they'd often just pick sort of the top candidates and say, well, would you vote for this person or would you vote for this person? And because Kevin Paffrath had this following coming into the race, he was listed as one of the top candidates. He was generally the only Democrat listed among the other top Republicans like Caitlyn Jenner and Larry Elder and Doug Ossie and Kevin Faulkner and so forth. And so I think a lot of respondents to those polls would say, oh, there's a Democrat, I'll go with him. And then, of course, once he started getting that kind of polling coming out, then you started seeing national profiles and Paffrath saying, this is the guy who could become the next governor of California. Yeah. And so sort of we go from there.
And why we're talking about him today.
Exactly.
Well, since we are talking about him today, what are his ideas? What are his platform points?
Yeah, so he has some really ambitious and unusual policy ideas. They include clearing all California streets of unhoused people within the first 60 days by mobilizing the National Guard and constructing or outfitting 80 large warehouses or empty malls to place the unhoused people, passing a massive infrastructure package, introducing a pilot project for what he calls a future schools program that would basically be a series of trade schools independent of the community college system, paying students $2,000 per month to learn the trades. And that's just in the first year. He also wants to legalize gambling, eliminate income taxes for people earning less than $250,000, basically revamping the state's water and wildfire management systems, creating these planned communities that would be net negative energy across the state from scratch. As you can tell, these are both extremely ambitious plans and also pretty heterodox. You don't really hear this kind of stuff from really anyone, Republican or Democrat.
Yeah. And so how is he going to pay for all of this if he's going to eliminate income tax for people earning less than $250,000 a year?
What he has said was that he would repurpose some of the money that has been dedicated to the high-speed rail project by legalizing gambling. He would tax casino proceeds. He also talked about floating a bond. Important to note that all of this would require legislative approval or voter approval. And it's not clear whether the math would really work out here, but those are some of the ideas that he has floated.
Okay, so out of all of these, because he does do a lot of YouTube videos on real estate, one mm-hmm. would think he'd have an expertise in housing. What is he saying about the affordable housing crisis in California?
Yeah, so I mean, he's talked sort of generally about wanting to streamline the process by which development occurs across the state. So I mean, he didn't get into a ton of specifics on that point, but essentially he thinks that it takes far too long to build anything in the state. And so he wants to strip that down to just a matter of weeks. Obviously, that's a big lift given that it often
it's
takes
now a matter of years. Yeah.
Yes, exactly. So that and it's no, you know, easy feat. Obviously, this is something that the legislature has been trying to get at for the last few years now, if not much longer. And so but that's sort of one hit of his top priorities. And then I also mentioned his main priority, his most immediate plan relates to homelessness, which would involve, as I said, clearing all California streets of people living on the street and then basically placing them in these what he calls Javits Center style warehouses or sort of, you know, field centers, which is a reference to the Javits Center in Manhattan, which was converted into a temporary field hospital during the pandemic. And actually, when we were talking to him, when he was talking to the staff at Cal Matters, you know, this is all over Zoom. And so he shared his screen and pulled up a picture of the Javits Center and sort of showed us exactly what he had in mind. And so I guess that's the model that he's working off of.
Right. And he is anti-mandatory vaccine, mandatory mask mandates.
Yeah, he kind of sort of took a balancing act approach to this, which is to say that he doesn't support them in principle, but that he was also very clear to say that any mandates in place when he takes office, if he were to take office, would stay in place. But yeah, I think philosophically, he doesn't believe in mandates. He said that the state should be doing more to encourage people to get vaccinated through, of course, social media challenges. He mentioned that because he's a product of the social media world. And also he said that he wants to potentially impose stricter air filtration requirements on businesses, and then maybe also sending N95 masks directly to households.
So is he running to actually be the governor or running to have a viable alternative for Newsom in case Newsom is indeed recalled?
So that's another thing that kind of distinguishes Paffrath from some of the other Democrats who are running. Paffrath very much supports the recall. He is very, very critical of Gavin Newsom. And so, no, he is not running to be an insurance policy. He would very much like to see the current governor replaced, obviously, by him. And so, and that kind of gets at his more sort of unusual political affiliation. As you mentioned, he describes himself as a JFK-style Democrat, which I think in his view means governing from the middle. He has somewhat more centrist views when it comes to things like concealed carry. He also believes that taxes should be a lot lower, regulations should be lower, but also believes in sort of launching these very ambitious social programs and infrastructure programs.
All right. So there you have it. Kevin Paffrath. Ben Christopher covers California politics and elections for Cal Matters. Ben, thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Coming up, if you were lucky enough to keep your job during the pandemic, you might have some extra cash, and personal finance columnist Michelle Singletary will be here to tell you what to do with it. Plus, Good Foods' Evan Kleinman will be here to tell you how to make a smash burger.
A smash burger is all about contact of the heat source to the patty. So you want it to be flat like a griddle, not open like a grill.
All that coming up next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. It's not just billionaires who have more money to fund their space travel these days. The average retirement account balance has hit an all-time high, up a little more than 20% compared to the same time last year. That's according to a new analysis from Fidelity Investments, the largest administrator of workplace retirement accounts. Fidelity also saw a jump in the number of millionaires among its clients. On the flip side, there are still millions of Americans out of work, taking on more debt and relying on government pandemic assistance. Michelle Singletary covers personal finance for The Washington Post. Hi, Michelle.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Well, it's great to have you back. We know the market is doing well. The Dow is up, what, by more than 5,000 points since its pre-pandemic high. So that's about 20%. And is that what's driving this increase in value in retirement accounts?
Yes, definitely. When you looked at the folks who were still contributing to their retirement plan, even during the pandemic, you see that their portfolios are, you know, exploded. And 85% of that came from market performance, and then the 15% from the contributions and increase in contributions. I think about 58% of folks who could do those catch up payments, so it's $6,500 if you're 50 or older, there was a huge increase in them. People said, listen, I've got some extra money. I'm going to put it in my retirement account.
I'm sure that makes your heart sing.
It does. It's like, oh, I mean, this is a little bit of the economy of the have and the have nots. I'm certainly happy that a lot of people were able to take advantage of not having to spend so much and increase their net wealth and worth and pay off some debt and save. But then there are also quite a number of people, millions of people who unfortunately, suffered and are still suffering because of the pandemic.
Right. One of the things I noticed regarding that is a lot more foot traffic at the dollar stores. Dollar General saw a 32% increase from its pre-pandemic numbers. That's incredible.
It is. It's very incredible. I mean, you know, there's a huge part of our population that, you know, we like to say people living a paycheck to paycheck, but these folks aren't even making it to that next paycheck. You know, halfway through their, you know, one pay period, they're running out of money, and the dollar stores allows them to get some things that they need for their family. Unfortunately, you know, it's not going to be fresh fruits. It's going to be canned, highly processed. And so while certainly, you know, you want them to have something to eat, the downside of that is that's not always the most healthier food choices for them.
Right. And grocery store prices are up across the board because inflation is up like over 5%. Why? What's driving that?
Well, a lot of it has to do with, you know, productivity, right? You know, those people who have to pack your food and can your food and ship your food. And, you know, they were sick. They have had to go home. They're trying to take care of kids. And so, you know, when there's a higher demand, you know, prices go up. And, you know, there's some thought that it's going to, you know, stabilize once we can get the coronavirus cases back down. And then we kind of return to normal. The prices should come down for a lot of things. Like, for example, you know, used cars, you know, people are clamoring for used cars. And so when there's a lot of people trying to go after a little bit of stuff, the prices go up.
I want to talk about the child tax credit. This was passed back in March of this year, the revamped version. Lots of changes, some permanent, some temporary. What are some of the bigger changes in the child tax credit?
Well, the biggest change is that people could get the money for the child tax credit in advance. Typically, you get the money when you file your return. So for 2021, credit was given to people in advance. From July, payments started in July, will run to December. So they're getting that money now because the need is now. People are still out of work, or if they went back to work, they're trying to recover from income that they lost because they were out of work because of COVID. And so depending on how many children you have and the age of the child, you can get a monthly payment. So children, infant to five, will get about up to $300 a month. And then children 6 to 17 who get $250 a month, and you'd get it from now until the end of the year, and you get the rest of that credit, which was increased overall next year when they file their tax returns.
So that must be a big game changer for people, just as you say, trying to live paycheck to paycheck.
You know, there's been a large portion of our country that has known this for quite some time. The pandemic sort of ripped the Band-Aid off of a lot of problems with our economy. People were just limping along, just barely making it. And COVID showed all of us how bad things were for people. That's why the stimulus payments, the advanced child tax credit payments have been, you know, a godsend for a lot of folks who just needed to put food on the table and keep the roof over their heads. And it was helpful to lift children in particular out of poverty so that they have something to eat and their families can make it until we come out of this COVID crisis.
Right. And so getting back to people who are more fortunate and were able to save during the pandemic, what is your advice for them? What should they do first with their extra money?
Well, if they've got extra money, I'm a debt hater. I hate debt.
Yeah.
I hate debt. If debt was a person, I'd slap it. I'm thinking, you know, if you were able to hold onto your job and there was no disruption to your income, you ought to target that debt. And many people did. They paid down their debt. They paid down their credit cards or paid them off. I actually even encouraged people who had federal student loans that were on pause to go ahead and make those payments and get that debt off your books, because right now the interest rate is 0%. So every dollar that you put towards that debt reduces your principal. And then there were other people who saved the money. They saved it either because they didn't need it or they were worried that their job might be in jeopardy down the road. And actually, they were quite smart because now we're in a second, you know, really big surge of cases. And so, you know, we know that before the pandemic, people weren't saving enough in their retirement. They weren't saving enough for an emergency fund. And so they put it away to help them in case they lose their job or something, or they become ill, that there's some money that can carry them over.
So there's lots of debt. I mean, there are different pockets of debt that you might have. You might have credit card debt. You might have student loan debt. You might have a home mortgage, if you're fortunate to have that. Car loan payment. Which one should you pay off first?
I like the method where you list your debts from the smallest to the largest. So if you've got a $200 debt, you list that first. If you've got a $1,000 debt, you list that next, and so on. Because I work with hundreds of people with their actual budgets, and this comes into behavioral economics. So when people are able to get rid of debt quickly, that actually energizes them and encourages them to continue to pay off debt. Now, many people say, oh, you got to go for the interest rate first. And, you know, they want to, you know, look at it by the math and, you know, people ought to do this. And these are people who don't actually work with real people. You know, things that look good on paper don't actually operate the same way in person. And I find that listing from smallest to the largest and tackling that. So it could be your student loan debt. It could be the credit card debt, whichever's the smallest, start there and quickly. And what studies have also shown was that when you do that, the interest rate, you actually end up paying less interest because you get rid of the debt quicker. So it is a proven way to get rid of debt that works for a lot of people.
Michelle Singletary, she covers personal finance for the Washington Post. Thanks for being here and thanks for your words of advice.
Thank you.
Evan Kleinman is here to tell us all about smash burgers, what they are, how to make them, where to get the best ones. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand.
Bon appetit.
Where's the lamb sauce?
Salty, sweet, and oaky nuttiness.
15-minute bake-off, Queens.
And then we add the whiskey. Boom! Flames.
Bam! That's a little bit like that.
Pie.
Well, Labor Day, if you can believe it, is right around the corner. Sad, because that means the end of summer. But glad, because it's a day that we can celebrate one last day of summer and fire up the barbecue. Today, we're going to talk about burgers, specifically smash burgers. And here to talk about them is, of course, Evan Kleinman, host of KCRW's Good Food. Hi there.
Hi.
All right. So burgers, it's a pretty cheap and simple item to cook. You just get a bunch of chuck, form a burger, and put it on the grill, right? I mean, it's that simple.
Well, you know, if you were to go on to certain chef scientist websites, it would not be that simple. But
I know people who make a living doing this, I know they would disagree. But let's talk about smash burgers. What, first of all, what are they?
So I really love smash burgers, and I think they're sort of the quintessential LA burger. You know, there's the bistro burger from the 90s, which is the really thick burger, beautifully made, curated, with a lot of different toppings that you really want to sit in a restaurant and have. The smash burger is just what it sounds like. The patty is smashed against not a grill, but a griddle, a very hot, flat surface. I make them at home in a cast iron pan. Until they become really, really deeply browned, and there perhaps will be a lacy edge. Now, most of the places who sell them in LA serve them topped with American cheese or another cheese and offer them with multiple patties. So you can get a one patty, two patty, three patty option. And then they come, the most simple way is usually with onion, ketchup and mustard, maybe lettuce, and pickles. Some gild the lily, but for me, that's sort of not necessary.
Well, you have to have good beef, right?
Yeah, you have to have good beef, but that means different things to different people, as we know.
What does it mean to you?
Well, to me, it means trying to not buy from the feedlot. So it means grass-fed beef. And I would say that Standings Butchery is doing a pop-up called Burgers by Standings. And it seemed, when I started asking all these Smashburger makers whose burger they would want to eat if they weren't going to eat their own, nearly all of them mentioned Standings. It's really, really great meat. But, you know, a lot of burger makers and restaurants and pretty much everybody all over town does buy from the feedlot market. And that's where you'll see Angus or prime meat. And they're trying to have a bit more fat in the patty because you want to have a nice amount of fat render out of the patty as it's being smashed so that you can get that Maillard reaction that gives you the incredible depth of flavor that you get from a smash burger.
Okay, explain the Maillard reaction.
So the Maillard reaction or the browning reaction is, think of it like a series of cascading transformations that happen when protein meets high heat. The protein molecules start to break apart into smaller compounds over and over and over again as they react to the heat. And that's what creates the complexity of flavor in any deeply browned food, from caramelized sugar to that burger patty.
Okay, so you say that you cook them in a cast iron pan. Is it best to do that? Cook them in a cast iron pan if you're cooking at home, or should we? Could we do them on? Well, I guess we can't do them on the grill because it's got to be one flat surface.
But, yeah, but a lot of people just take a griddle that they have in the house and throw it on their grill and heat it up there. That's what I do with my cast iron pan, so I can be outside. That way, I don't have this. You know, I'm not at risk of turning on the fire alarm.
And the idea is that you want to keep the fat in the pan. You don't want it to be dripping down into the coals.
You don't want it to be dripping down into the coals, and you also want total contact. A smash burger is all about contact of the heat source to the patty. So you want it to be flat like a griddle, not open like a grill.
And how thick is it, a smash burger?
They're not thick. They're, I would say, maximum just under half an inch. Some are even thinner than that. So usually the standard order for most people, unless you're a really light eater, is a double. I mean, you can basically think of the In-N-Out burger as sort of like the template of a smash burger or a McDonald's burger. And so all these guys out here and women that are making smash burgers in pop-ups and in brick and mortars are just trying to take that template and make it just much better, higher quality.
All right, Evan, where are some good places to get a smash burger if you don't want to make it yourself?
So Burgers by Standings, as I've already mentioned, they pop up at Tabula Raza Bar in East Hollywood and at Glendale Tap. A lot of the smash burger places that do pop-ups do partner with a brewery, which makes a lot of sense. Gold Burger is a brick and mortar in Highland Park, and they have Los Feliz coming pretty soon. I would get the grass-fed California Classic, which is a double patty with cheese, shredded lettuce, onions, pickles, garlic, and a garlic mustard aioli. Then I just love Hangabers, which is a pop-up in El Sereno. That's Alicia Lopez and Cecilia Ledesma. They're a married couple and the only female-run created smash place that I know of. And they take their Latin style to create the tapique, which includes a grilled ham slice, American cheese, grilled panela cheese, and some spicy mustard crema. And I could just keep on going. You know, there's just put smash burger in Google and you'll see what happens. Or just go to our website and I have several for you.
Okay, that's kcrw.com. I am again drooling thinking of eating all this stuff. You've made me hungry yet again. Evan, before you go, tell us what's on your show this week.
This week, we're doing a deep dive into food writing. And I talked to so many interesting people, from a science fiction novelist. I asked her how she goes about creating food that doesn't exist, to a cooking teacher and longtime pastry chef who takes fantasy food or food in fiction and then makes real recipes out of them. It's a really fun show.
Wow, it sounds like it. Okay, it's always a great show, by the way, so you should always check it out. It's on Saturday mornings at 11. Good food, don't miss it. Evan Kleiman, thank you.
Thank you.
All right, Tim, that does it for us today. Don't forget, you can download or subscribe to our podcast and listen whenever and wherever you want, maybe while you're eating a smash burger. It's at ksrw.com/pressplay or wherever else you get your podcasts. I'm Madeline Brand. Thanks for listening. I'll see you tomorrow.